So welcome to Gotta Catch 'Em All's. What treasures are our kids collecting in Pokemon? And I'll start by introducing myself. I'm Jenny Pro, and I'm actually an anthropologist who studies contemporary Japan, specifically Japanese media. So that's the perspective I'm coming to this from. And I teach in the Honors College at Valparaiso University about contemporary Japan. I should say I'm not a Pokemon expert, which is to say the kids in the room probably know more about it than me from a different perspective. I have not played all the variations or seen all the anime, but I have some exposure. I've seen much of the first couple seasons, and I've played the first Game Boy game, and I have some familiarity. When I was in grad school, my advisor was doing work on Japanese kids' toys and wrote her book on Pokemon. And Power Rangers and others. But I'm mostly talking today from a book called Pikachu's Global Adventure, which is written by a group of scholars, Japanese scholars, media scholars, educators, and parents and their kids, right when Pokemon was sort of at its peak, thinking about sort of what is this and what do we do about it and is it good or bad or what are we going to do? Go sit with Daddy for a second. That's my son Emmett. He wants to introduce himself. He's 5. This is actually his first introduction to Pokemon, so I may regret it. We'll see.
Jenny, sorry for this interruption. He would like to introduce himself.
Oh, okay.
Because they don't know his name.
That's true. Okay. You can, quickly.
My name is Emmett. I don't know that much about Pokemon too either. So, and she's my mom that's talking about it today.
Thank you,
Evan. Okay.
Yay. Good job. Good introduction. Okay, so do we have any people here who play or have played Pokemon? Yeah, a few? Any parents of Pokemon players? Grandparents of Pokemon players? All right. Well, let's start out with a little thought exercise. What is Pokemon? Throw out any idea. Anything you know.
Stuff that do attacks.
Yeah, they do attacks. That's right. Pokemon stands for pocket monsters.
Mm-hmm. The hula hoop of the 2000s.
The hula hoop of the 2000s, yes. Yes, and its peak really was from 1996 to 2001. That's when it had the broadest appeal and the broadest audience. It's still popular amongst grade school kids, but it was broader before 2001. Anything else? What else?
It's both games and books and, I guess there's probably cartoon versions of them, but I'm not sure, live action.
Right. It's across a whole bunch of media. It's hard to sort of, that's why I started with what is it, because yeah. You can't sort of pinpoint one thing. It's an animated cartoon. There are books about it. There are Game Boy games, trading card games, stuffed toys. It's this whole compendium.
Can we get a stuffed toy Pokemon?
Yes.
It's on TV.
It's on TV, that's right. There's animated shows on TV.
Mm-hmm. It struck me as a stunningly successful marketing enterprise.
It was marketing brilliance, that's for sure, or evil, depending on your perspective or your pocketbook if you're the parent shelling out for all the various versions that you need to get. And as I'll talk about, some of that was accidental, but they hit on a sort of winning formula that a lot of other things are starting to do now. Of course, we've always had character marketing from kids' toys, right? I mean, even when I was a kid, you had toys from the cartoons, and of course, toy and cereal commercials during cartoons, right? I mean, we've known sort of what that market was for a long time. But because of this configuration of media, it sort of hit on this different kind of success. What else is Pokemon? Are there just monsters? Who else is in it?
Trainers,
right. What do the trainers do?
Train the Pokemon.
Train the Pokemon, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Battle people.
And they battle, right? They battle other trainers with their Pokemon, with their monsters, right? That they've trained. Let's see, anything else? Anything we missed?
No.
All right, well, I want to suggest that because it's this weird configuration of things, In order to get a handle on it, I want to think about it in three ways. First, as a text. It's a TV show. We're not used to thinking about TV shows as text, but they're texts of a sort. As a format, because you play it across all these different games. And as a practice, because it's not just a TV show that you're sitting and watching. In fact, you have to interact across these medium and to be successful, actually, with other kids doing it. So it's a text. There is a narrative to it. It was a video game first, but there's the animated cartoon, and it was a comic book. And the main narrative follows the story of a young boy, and I'll just say the American names, named Ash Ketchum. And his main Pokemon is Pikachu, who's the yellow guy. Let's see if I have a picture of him.
Use the clicker.
Yeah, that's not working. Oh, I forgot my book held up. Okay. Here's, So Ash Ketchum is the main character, and he has this yellow, the infamous yellow guy as Pikachu. And there's been a range of friends that travel with him. Here's a whole bunch of Pokemon. Here's Ash and Pikachu.
Okay.
He has a range of friends that travel with him. The original girl, the original series had a girl named Misty. There have been other friends. Brock travels with him sometimes. May and Dawn are other girls. There's a whole bunch of people that travel in the Pokemon world. And what they do is they wander around in different worlds and catch pocket monsters in the wild. They have these balls that they catch them in, and then they train them to fight, and they find out about competitions, and two teams will take their pocket monsters to the challenges and fight them. So that's the main storyline. And, yes, did you say the mouse is the one that was working?
No, the
clicker is? So this is Team Rocket. This is the bad guy team. There's Pikachu and Ash, and this is Mewith, and Jesse and Jake. They're the bad guys. They're the bad team that Ash and his friends are sort of always fighting about. Team Rocket tries to steal their Pokemon once they've been successful, and a lot of the sort of shenanigans in the animated video revolve around these rivalries and trying to get pocket monsters. In the game, a big part of it is actually battling the monsters themselves. So there is some narrative to it, and this is basically what you're trying to do. The monsters themselves do, that's Meowth, that's right. The monsters themselves do evolve. So Pikachu is first Pichu, and then he evolves into Pikachu and evolves into Raichu. This is Meowth, and he evolves into Persian. Charmander, who's like a little lizard with fire, evolves into Charmeleon, into Charizard. Squirtle, who's a little turtle, evolves into Wurtle and Blastoise. So, and there's tons and tons of these monsters. There was 151 at first, but we've expanded significantly since then. So they all evolve, and in the game, you have to, you know, reach different levels to get them to evolve and do different things, but just so you know, the monsters evolve. That's all a part of the narrative, the text. The format, as we talked about, is sort of across genres. You have the animated show, the TV show, the cartoon. In Japan, you had comic books. Some of the comic books are here, and they have them in novel forms. They were more popular in Japan. It's also the Game Boy games, and they're handheld video games primarily. And then the trading cards, and I'll pass some trading cards around just so you can see what they're like. They're the most portable part. And that is one of the things about the game, is that it's almost all portable, with the exception of the animation. It's all portable. It can fit into any sort of nook and cranny of your life. In the context of Japan, where in Tokyo, where kids have long commutes, you can take your Game Boy game, you can take your cards, you can take it with you, sort of in a variety of ways. So it's across a variety of formats, most of which are portable. And I'll talk a little bit more about the trading cards later, but that's just so you can see some information. And the final thing, the practice, again, because it's all these various formats, You play across them in a variety of ways. You can watch the animated show and play out that narrative with your friend. You can have the cards and play out that with your friends. You can play the game. You practice the practice of Pokemon, as scholars have started to talk about, is sort of across these genres. And that's one of the things that makes it unique, is that there's this play space. To really get the most out of it, you have to play across all these genres. And that's directly applicable in the video games, because to be successful in the Game Boy game, you literally have to hook your Game Boy up to another person's Game Boy and exchange monsters. So there was a built-in sort of sociality to the video game, which again is one of the things that was new, and the opposite of the way we're used to thinking about video games, right? This, they atomize us, where these individuals only playing games, and so there's a built-in sort of sociality. So I want to talk a little bit now and then about the origin of Pokemon. How did this get started, and how did it build into this configuration, and how did it get to the US? And then I'll open it up for some questions and comments after that. In Japan, in about 1995, Nintendo contracted with a young man named Taijiri Satoshi to build a video game. And they wanted him to build a game that would attract a younger group of kids. Mostly grade school and middle school. Sony had the market on teen games, and Nintendo, which had been big, was sort of losing out, and they wanted to attract a new market. And they wanted a game that could get kids earlier and then might stay with the Nintendo platform. So they contracted him to make an imaginative game that kids could play, and again, that would attract a wide range of audiences. His own goal was to make an imaginative game that would help relieve the stress of living in the post-industrial world. So Satoshi had grown up in a rural area in Japan and had played in the woods and collected bugs and had this really outdoorsy childhood. And he felt bad for the kids in Tokyo, right, who commute to school and don't have any nature and have really hard schooling and exam pressures, and so he wanted a game that would mimic or enable them to play in the imaginative ways that he played as a young boy. I'm sure many of you can sort of identify with that. We have similar conversations, especially here at Holden, right? Oh, kids don't just play outside anymore. Well, here we can, but in our everyday lives, it's a little bit different. And then in the context of sort of urban Tokyo, Satoshi really wanted to sort of bring some of nature and a natural childhood into post-industrial Japanese life. That was his goal, anyway. And so what he used to construct the gaming world really was his own childhood of bug collecting. He collected bugs, and he particularly liked to fight beetles, which isn't something I'm familiar with, but apparently it's something people do. And so he knew a lot of bugs, and so he really mimicked this game after that, right? You have the evolution, bugs don't evolve to that extent, but you can see the links to nature that he's making there. You can buy whole official Pokemon handbooks and read. It's almost, I mean, it's a literal fantasy taxonomy of all the different characters and where they evolve to and from. So he pulled from that sort of natural part of his childhood to make this game. And I think that is one reason that it was popular. I mean, did anybody collect things as kids? There's kind of a naturalness to collecting something. We collect stamps or coins or bugs, or I collected Ranger Rick cards and endlessly reorganized them because I was a budding social scientist. But we collect things. And this is sort of a fantasy collection, right? And you can learn all about all these monsters. So he was both trying to bring nature into the city and break up the sort of the atomism, the loneliness of urban life. So he built the sociality into it. Parts of the games you actually have to exchange with other people in order to get further, as I said. So he pitched this game to Nintendo, and they thought, oh, we'll give it a try. It was immediate success. The game was out. There was no narrative to go with it, no TV show or comic book yet. It was immediate success, sold out right away. Nintendo talked pretty early on with Shogakukan, which is one of the main publishing houses, about making a comic book for it. And they wrote the narrative that would go with the game. And from that story, which was very popular, they quickly made an anime, all sorts of character goods, and then the trading card game. And there you have the sort of media mix, as it's called in Japan, of Pokemon. And this configuration was really successful, although its initial finding was a little bit accidental. And they didn't start out with the plan to do all that. Although this is the way Japanese kids' media works. Typically, if a comic book is really popular, then they make it into an anime, and they make more money off selling rights to animes and toys and other books than they do off the original comic itself. That's just how kids' marketing works. The other thing that they found was because of this media mix, you could reach a really wide range of ages of kids. And they found they were targeting boys, but they found girls really liked it. Because Pikachu was the main character, and he was cute and fluffy, girls and boys both liked him. So kids ages 4 to 7 would sort of play with the narrative. The educators in this book say kids 4 to 7 tend to be the monsters themselves. I can attest to that. I was Squirtle earlier this week in a game that also involved Aslan and R2-D2. So there's a different kind of creativity. So kids 4 to 7 tend to be the monsters themselves. They're most interested in the cute monsters and what they can do. And they tend to watch the anime more than play the Game Boy game. After 7 to 9, they get more into the Game Boy game and the trading card games. 4 to 7, they play with the cards, but they don't quite know what to do with them. They don't know what the rules are. When they get a little older, they can get the rules of the game. It's a pretty elaborate trading card game. And they can get more into the rules of the video game. And so their knowledge sort of grows with it. They tend to stop watching the animation now. And they tend to identify with the trainers more than the monsters themselves. And then 10 to 13, they could master the trading card game, move on to other games like Magic and other related trading card games or other video games. And that was the original sort of configuration. I think today it's not at its peak, and it tends to stop. It's biggest amongst kids, I think, sort of 6 to 9, and they stick with the anime and the original video games and stuff. But originally at its peak, again, it was at its peak from sort of started in 96, and it really peaked in 2001. So this was widely popular, and very quickly, three American companies started talking to Nintendo in Japan to start marketing it for the US. One was 4 Kids Entertainment, which is a cartoon company. They put a lot of Saturday morning cartoons on. Wizards of the Coast, which makes Magic and other trading card games, contracted for the trading cards. They were doing the trading cards for the Japanese version anyway. And then, who am I forgetting? Nintendo USA, which is a subsidiary of Nintendo in Japan, all started working on how do we adapt this for the U.S. market. And anytime we think about translation, obviously you have to translate the whole text into English, right? Kids don't speak Japanese. But there's always a different level of translation, right? Do you keep it really close to the original, or do you sort of translate it culturally as well so it's really reader-friendly, or in this case, audience-friendly? And that process, if you're very much towards the reader or audience-friendly realm, is called localization. And they chose to localize Pokemon, which is to say they changed quite a bit so it would fit American kids, feel like American TV, and sort of not feel particularly Japanese. And they did this in a variety of ways. They changed all the text to English, obviously. And you can do that more or less. They changed sort of almost everything from like tiny signs and things that were in the corners of the animation. They changed everything into English. They also changed colloquialisms. I'll change it soon. They changed colloquialisms and even sometimes plots to make them fit more with things American kids were interested in. So it was pretty significantly, I mean, the animation stayed the same, but the dialogue changed sort of what was going on. They even changed the music and the credits. It was very thoroughly localized. Another thing that they did was make the animation series. In Japanese, animations tend to be really long narrative serials, so they connect one to another. But our cartoons for kids are all standalone episodes, like sitcoms. So they felt that American kids wouldn't follow a long serialized narrative. And so the Pokemon anime here are much more like standalone episodes. They also released the anime first, the animated text first, before the video game here, so that and the video came about 8 months later, so kids were thoroughly into the story of Pokemon before they bought the video game here, which was sort of flipped from the way it was done in Japan. Some other sort of surprising things they changed is they made it less cute and more bold. This was the one of the things that they, for kids' entertainment, talks about in particular. Japanese animation is very cute, and American kids need something that's brighter and bolder. So they changed the colors even slightly to be more primary. And rather than Pikachu being the main character, which he was in the original, Ash, the boy hero, becomes the main character. Pikachu's there and a very important part of it, but Ash is really the main character. And this shifts sort of the tenor of it a little bit as well. Once Ash is the hero, it also becomes a little bit more individualistic. He is really the main guy, and you're following his trials and successes all along the story. In the original Japanese version, his successes were always contingent on the people who were there with him. There was a lot more focus on the development of their relationship. So there were whole anime shows that were about, really, character and relationship development that we just tossed out because we were like, kids aren't going to watch that boring stuff. So there was a different kind of focus. It was less on, Ash is still, Satoshi is his name in Japanese. He's still the main character in the Japanese one, but there was more focus on the different, how they work together to sort of solve things than in the American one. And you can imagine why that would be so. Also, the stories, the plots themselves, and the characters became more black and white. The Four Kids Entertainment has this really unfortunate quote where they said, American kids don't get subtlety. So we need everything to be black and white. I mean, this is our tradition in our media. This says more about our media than our kids, I think. But the good characters got sort of more good. In Japanese animation, there's more ambiguity. The heroes have flaws and they struggle, even though you know who the good and the bad side is. Likewise, the bad guys, there will be whole episodes where you're sympathetic with them, you know where they come from. It's a little more complicated. That got more stark in the American version. Most of what they did was make Ash the main character, and Team Rocket got more sort of despicable and diabolical. They're clumsy, and they're particularly narcissistic, and they're just more diabolical. So we mostly just made the bad guys worse. And the final thing they changed was a little bit less violence. This was aimed at really young kids in Japan, and so there's violence in it, but not to the same level. But there were a few episodes that were deemed too violent still for American kids that age that were taken out. And of course, the infamous episode from 1997 where that caused epileptic seizures. Do you remember?
Oregon.
This? Yeah. There was a flash of red and blue, red and blue, red and blue, and hundreds of kids in Japan had epileptic seizures. They pulled it right away. And we didn't translate that one.
They banned quite a few episodes.
And they did. They changed quite a few.
Like the one where Ash gets a gun pointed at his face.
Yes. By a Western cowboy, ironically. Yeah. So there are some like that where there were particular violent episodes that they deemed not too violent for the young kids in the U.S. Again, so those are the main ways they changed it for a U.S. audience. And one sort of interesting thing is that when they exported it to Latin America and Europe, they used the American version to translate. In Asia, the Japanese version gets translated for China and Korea and Taiwan. But because 4Kids Entertainment and Nintendo USA had essentially the distribution routes all sorted out, they translate the American ones for the European audiences, which is just sort of fascinating aside to me. So, this was wildly successful in the US as well. You may remember bits and pieces of the Poke craze when it was at its peak. And it sort of culminated in what I think in the, oh, these are the cards. In this ANA plane, which gets a lot of press. You can still fly on it. And all your goods have little Pokemon characters on it. And then, of course, the pinnacle of character marketing in the U.S. is to make it to the Macy's Parade, which Pikachu did in, I think it's 2000. So this was wildly successful and started to die off in end of 2001. So that's my sort of main overview of where this all came from. And I want to pause here to get responses or questions, or those of you who play. Do you have different experiences of it, or what do you think? Yeah.
I find it very interesting, the changes that were made between the Japanese original and the American. So who was responsible for deciding how the American version was going to be different? Were they Japanese people who decided? Were they American people who decided?
They let, and this is common for most of the stuff that both goes to China and comes here. They believe strongly that the people in the place know best what will sell. So they really left it up to 4Kids Entertainment, Nintendo USA, and Wizards of the Coast, although everything always had to be run back by Nintendo, and in terms of the comics, Shogakukan and the artist Satoshi got some rights to it. But they really felt strongly that, you know, people in American media would know best what would sell to American kids. And there is a longer legacy of trying to get Japanese animation onto mainstream TV. By the 90s, when this was popular, quite a bit was on TV. But when I was interviewing, in the 70s, they would try and get Doraemon and other really popular anime onto American TV. And the producers here would say, it's too Japanese. Too many Japanese things. We can't erase all those chopsticks and rice balls and tatami. And it's too Japanese. And so by the 90s, there was a different moment where, A, Japanese-ness was a little bit more okay. American kids were more used to it. But also, they let these companies sort of saw ways to make it American. But yeah, I was surprised, too, at how many, the level of things that get changed from, like, bolder colors and things like that.
Well, it says so much about, that's why it was interesting to me to hear who made the changes, mm-hmm. because it says so much, if it had been the Japanese people, what their opinion, perspective,
right, their stereotypes,
analysis
yeah.
of the American audience would be. But here it's American producers who make the changes.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
very complimentary.
Yeah, yeah. There was a hand back here, and then yours. Did you have something?
No.
Yes.
Who's still creating the new Pokemon games and new Pokemon shows today? Or is it still the same person?
Satoshi is still involved to some extent, but it's kind of grown into a huge conglomerate. So now there's a lot of people working on it in Japan. And I think in the U.S., and I know less about what's happening with it directly now than I do in 2001, but the U.S. market is typically behind. It comes out in Japan first, and then it's translated for here. So.
Did the U.S. version of the Nintendo game also include the fact that you had to connect it to somebody else's
yes.
to pass to new levels?
I was struck by your comment about how the cartoons are made more black and white for American audiences because Americans can't handle complexity. And that's one of my biggest concerns about our society has mm-hmm. been our seeming inability to see beyond the black and white.
Right.
And what's interesting, either the cartoon makers were perceptive or they're leading us into
yeah. Right. Yeah, it sort of depends on your view of
yeah.
media suasion,
yeah.
how
it's
you take
little
that.
Little
yeah.
tricky.
Although I think, I would argue that, and other scholars have argued, that Japanese animation and manga are particularly popular here right now because they're more complicated, ambiguous plots. They do with animation and comic books things that we never did. We had clear black and whites, and it's just more complicated. You play out, if you have a moral issue, you play out all sides of it before deciding what to do, rather than having clear sides. And so when you talk to fans about why they like manga and anime instead of American comic books, that's one of the first things they point to. It's more complicated in plots, adult themes, things like that.
You mentioned the creator of Pokemon had to bring some positive stimulation to kids with low communities,
mm-hmm.
some sort of stress relief, form of relief. So I was curious as a parent what your views are on what the impacts have been, either in Japan or in America, of Pokemon.
Well, it's complicated, and as a parent I haven't quite encountered it yet, but I was going to actually, a little bit later after this question and answer, talk about potential effects.
Okay.
So we will get there, actually. Yes. Do you have a comment? No? Mm-hmm.
I don't have a question, but when I was in high school, I spent a summer in Japan, and my host sister, my host mom, and my host sister's two kids just came to visit us the week before we came to Holden. Mm. And so Kazuma is Isaac's age and really into Pokemon. So these two just had a great time comparing their cards and all the different names. And so, like, I have really mixed feelings about Pokemon. But in that case, the whole social aspect of it was really fascinating, and having these two, like, do all these comparisons. And there was enough of a language barrier between the two boys that, you know, were Cosmo to notice any of the kind of subtleties, because he doesn't really watch the cartoons, but we did get a couple so that Cosmo could see them. He wouldn't have been able to really tell us that anyway, even if he would have noticed. And I don't know if he would have, but it would have been interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. And that is one of the things that the parents in here all say, is that this Pokemon was never an isolated thing. It was never something that kids did only alone in their room, because to really get the most out of it, you're going to manage all that all that knowledge, all that information, you want to talk to other people about it. So it was, even if it's fantasy, it was inherently social in that way. And especially it was striking with the video game to make Game Boys, which we think of as, you know, oh, I'm just sitting here with my Game Boy, but to actually integrate something where you have to exchange to get further. You didn't have to exchange to win, but to get really far and to get more monsters, you had to exchange.
You said so after 2001, sorry to after its peak. Was it replaced by something else? Is it a limited lifespan? Is it, you know, a few years for these?
Yeah, Nintendo and the kids marketers, both here in Japan, would say kids market is the hardest. To a parent, it seems like it's the easiest because there's so many fads. But from the marketing perspective, kids latch onto things and then they want it and then they are done with it. So it's really hard to keep them going. But yeah, I mean, there's Yu-Gi-Oh! Followed a very similar pattern. It was popular in Japan, and then here, Beyblades were around. There's a whole bunch of them. But none of them have hit quite the same sort of peak that Pokemon did as the first one. And Pokemon is still really popular amongst grade school kids in Japan, I'm pretty sure, and it is somewhat popular here. But again, much shorter than when it was at its peak. Yeah.
I've been playing Pokemon games pretty much my entire life, and without those, I probably wouldn't have made two of my best friends today. Like, one of the examples is, I was on my school bus every day, and it's about a 30-hour ride, so I bring along my Game Boy.
30-minute,
yeah. 30-minute ride.
Oh. And then you can play together?
No. So what happened is, I was sitting in a three-seat section, and I would sit next to my sister. And then there was this teacher who would always get on and sit right next to me, so I couldn't keep playing my Game Boy. So I noticed that one of my friend's friends was on the same bus that I was, and he got on the first stop before the teacher. So one day, I invited him to come sit next to me, so that the teacher would have to go sit somewhere else, and I could keep playing my Game Boy, and now he's like one of my best friends.
See, there you go, an account of Pokemon friendship. Yeah, and this is all, there's even some kids who write stories in who write articles in this book who say the same thing.
I've also played probably over 1,000 hours of Pokemon games in my entire life. And I just feel like it's kind of lost something from going from my favorites, Gold and Silver, to Diamond, Pearl, and Platinum.
Yeah, I think anytime you try and keep something alive for that long, it's never gonna, like...
The gameplay's gotten a lot better, exciting. But it just doesn't feel the same
it
way.
It doesn't feel the same. Yeah, and then... You want to sit up here by me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, do you have a question? We're not quite done yet. Yeah, we can. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
You can sit right there.
I've been collecting Pokemon, and I say I have like 700 cards. And about the books or the cards, I never would have longed to read. I read them so much. I love those Pokemon books.
Yeah, they're filled with information, and yeah, there you go, there's another account. And you've seen the cards, right? There's a lot of detail on here. Some of them they even have, of course, you may need bifocals to read them, kids don't. They have their height and weight on here, right? And in the books, there's even more incredible amounts of detail about each monster. It really is a pretend tax, a fantasy taxonomy. Well, I do, any other questions?
This isn't a question, just a comment. 9 years ago when my 16-year-old was in first grade, his elementary school had to prohibit students from bringing the cards to class, to school.
To school, yeah.
Because they were so disruptive. The kids could not focus.
Yeah,
that happened in high school.
And that didn't happen in Japan. There is actually, if you're interested, this book is in the bookstore. Interested in it. There's an article about the fears about Pokemon that happened here. And they did have to ban it from, kids were stealing each other's cards, and I mean, it was like a frenzy for a brief period of time. And that didn't happen in Japan, I think, because it was new in Japan and it was really popular, but because it fit a little bit more with the way other games and toys were marketed. And maybe that's why.
And their school system is different.
And their school system is different. Far more structured.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I do want to turn a little bit to some of the effects that scholars have thought about. And again, this is mostly out of this book. But the main issues are, one of the things that Pokemon definitely teaches is capitalism, right? Acquisition. You've got to catch them all. And this happens on a variety of levels. You want to acquire more and more monsters if you're in the context of the game or the story. You do actually possess these monsters, and the goal is to have more and more and more of them. But also, to play it, as you mentioned, how much money you've spent on video games, right? The cards cost money, the video games cost money, doesn't cost money to share with your friends. The animations don't cost money. But to really fully participate, you do have to buy a lot of things. The cards in particular come in small packs, and you have to buy more and more of them, each one, or ideally you'll get more and more rare ones. There's a kind of trading economy in here to getting them. At the most extreme examples, people will buy cards for $200-$300 on eBay because it's a really rare one. So there's a whole economy to the trading cards, not unlike baseball cards or any other card collectibles. But there is built in a kind of acquisitiveness in here that I think parallels contemporary capitalism. It's also very flexible in the way that we talk about contemporary capitalism. Capital can move across barriers much more easily than it used to. And it's information-based, which is another way we characterize our contemporary economy. As you pointed out, you can learn all this information, and that is part of the knowledge you gain and what you share with your friends. So there are a lot of ways it teaches capitalism, and it teaches kids to be consumers, both again within the format of the game because they're possessing monsters and trading them and battling them, but also because built in, you can never have enough trading cards at the bottom line. So there's two different ways that scholars go with this. A lot of scholars are Marxists, and so then this is a bad thing, right? We don't want to teach rampant consumerism to our kids, or they get it enough anyway, so we don't want to encourage it in other ways. Others argue that, you know what, like it or not, we live in a capitalist economy, and this teaches kind of day trading or economy life skills in a way. So you can kind of go either way of it with that. That is one of the parts of it that makes me more nervous. Especially getting into the buying and selling of expensive cards, and that gets complicated. But I have my own issues with baseball trading and Beanie Babies. We have a friend whose high school son collected Beanie Babies, and all through high school found the cheapest Beanie Babies he could, but that were rare, and sold them all and put himself through college, which is its own kind of success story, but also kind of creepy. So maybe I don't completely get the sort of collector's buying and selling mentality, but that is built in both to the game and into sort of the practice of how you can play it with Pokemon. Another part of Pokemon is knowledge acquisition. Even if it's not the same as characterizing actual bugs, which one could argue does or does not have use value, you are learning knowledge, data collection, reading these books, you're putting together pieces. In chapter 7, there's a media scholar named Julian Stephen Green who argues that watching his son engage with Pokemon was really not much different than academic practice. Gaining a whole bunch of knowledge, being able to articulate the important parts, talking to your friends about it, it's knowledge gathering. And so he argues in his chapter that these are... this is fantasy, but it's grooming kinds of academic skills that we actually encourage in other ways. And so he's arguing that this is kind of interesting. If you look at the posters, the original posters, it actually looks like a periodic table with the Pokemons and what their numbers and what they evolve into. I mean, that scientific or natural sort of model is what it's taken off of. So it can teach sort of through fantasy these structures that we end up teaching in other ways in schools. So he argues that it could be useful in that way. It's also, and I think this is particularly important to why it was so popular, it's a whole bunch of knowledge that your parents don't get. You can learn all of this amazing stuff and they just don't get it. So you can share that with your friends, and that's an important part of childhood, right? Having things that you can share with your friends that are safe, but your parents don't get. And I think when you read the articles that are written by parents and children, or articles where they did research with children, that was something that they loved. That they could talk about this, and their parents just didn't quite get it, but their friends got it. And that was a real bonding mechanism around that. Others argue that kids learn media proficiency, whether we like it or not. We're in a media-saturated world, and they learn how to negotiate video games, how to go across these different formats, how to analyze an animated TV show, because with this, you're constantly comparing at some level the anime with the other knowledge you get. Whether it's knowledge about the monsters from the books or from the game, you're constantly putting those things in dialogue. And also, the game is very much a puzzle adventure game. It's not a linear, you have to do this and you end up here. You find your own ways through it. There's some structure to it, but you find your own ways through it. And you can get to the end without having collected all the Pokemon and like go back and get them. So there's some kind of flexibility in the game. So it does teach a kind of puzzle logic, puzzle solving. And then the final thing that's argued, as I've said, is that this is inherently a social practice with new media. And we think a lot now about social networking and new media, and are these things good or bad, or what do we do with them? And that's not really solved, but this is inherently social as a phenomenon. You don't really read any accounts of kids who just sort of did this on their own, in part because, well, now they just sort of stop doing it when their friends aren't into it anymore. And it is something now that it has more of a tendency to outgrow. It is inherently social between the gaps of all these things, and in putting all these various media together, there's a lot of room for creative play across social media. So those are the main arguments laid out in this book, and really my advisor was doing work on building on that part of her argument as well. Her name is Anne Allison. She has a book similarly called Millennial Monsters that's about Japanese pop culture, about Pokemon and Power Ranger and Sailor Moon and Tamagotchi and some of the popular Japanese pop cultures, or popular toys that have been on both sides of the ocean recently. So I guess I want to open up then to your experiences of what may or may not be beneficial to this, to parents or to kids. Any other responses to potential effects of this? And some would say we ask too much of our media. Maybe kids should be able to just have fun. But we really do want most of our toys for kids to be educational in some way, or we think about, well, what are they learning from this or not? So.
It was a fascinating thing to me. I'm a collector by genetics, I believe. We talk about the collector gene. If I see that there's two of something, I start thinking about having all of them. So this would be a natural for me. I probably lived vicariously through my son when he was much younger, but by helping him.
By helping him collect, yes.
But it's, you know, if I think about it, what's, you know, I collect minerals now, I kind of have to settle myself down. And those are naturally occurring, and
right, so
you can find it. But I usually don't. I buy them. Other people collect coins. Those are man-made. They may have history to them that a playing card doesn't have until you start getting baseball cards and things. But so I've been sort of torn between seeing a created collecting hobby and on one side, which seems negative, and just saying, well, it's collecting could be good. You become an expert at something, and whether it's stamps or coins or Pokemon, does that really matter? You're becoming an expert.
It's true. It's true. And I think that was one of the big appeals for a lot of kids, is this is something they can become an expert at, right? I mean, whether it's collecting or through the books or not. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I did with my Ranger Root cards. I endlessly reorganized them by file and genome, whatever.
Mm-hmm. I think for us, you know, the biggest drawback at first was around the violence and the battling and all of that. And, you know, we tried really hard when our kids were even younger to have a no-violence household. And I guess I've gotten to the point where you realize it's pretty much impossible. You know, so, I don't know, I don't let the bad of that outweigh something good.
Right. Yeah, we have the same thing. We banned guns, but we have endless sticks that are every hiking stick, every stick, and Rocky walks by is a lightsaber.
Right.
I don't know if there's that much difference. So some of that is a part of wider popular culture, not part of them.
Yeah, I mean the social aspect of it. Now, you know, Isaac hasn't watched a lot of the shows and. We don't have a DS, and so he doesn't play the game. It's the trading cards, which I think started kind of just by himself, but very quickly he has a very good friend that they spend hours, and they make their, you know, I really like the creative aspect. I've had mixed feelings about Pokemon, but, you know, one of the things I really liked, you know, they spend hours making their own Pokemon and designing them and figuring out what they do, and this has been like a mechanism to grow their friendship too. Mm-hmm. So that part of it has been really good. And actually, you know, there's so many toys that there's one thing they can do with it, and they don't foster creativity, and that always bothers me. And it's weird to me, but somehow this really has fostered a lot of creativity with him and given him a form for that.
There is, bizarrely in this, a lot of space between.
Yes.
I just wondering if you could say anything about sort of gender roles in both anime in general, like when you put the guy and the girl, I just wondered, sometimes, you know, and also whether the animals themselves are gendered. You know, like if you have a sense that some are boys and some are,
They are gendered a little bit more in terms of marketing. There were some that they thought would appeal to girls more, the butterfly ones, and there are some that are pink. Although some of the pink ones are the most powerful. So those categories of sort of primary colors versus pastel colors are absolutely in there with the monsters. They're not, and I should ask my Pokemon, the people who know the most about Pokemon, are they really gendered, the monsters?
Yes.
In the newer games, they have different ball genders. You can actually breed them now.
You can breed them now?
Oh, yeah, like me and my
friends.
You
can breed them?
I'm 17, and the new games are so complicated. They have the basic system, but there's a new, like, training system and breeding skill.
I have EVs.
Yeah, to get the best ones, it takes, I've spent 50 hours trying to get one team, because all my friends do it, too. Like, I'm 17, and I still play the games.
So Pokemon is breeding and has evolved into breeding, which, again, I know more about the original version. In the original animes, Misty and Ash had a pretty similar role. And again, I don't know more about the most current ones, but it's because they want girls to play it. They wanted girls to play it as well, so you need a strong girl for them to identify with. Anime in general, there's more boys anime than there is girls anime, but there's a whole genre of animation and manga targeting girls, with girls as the main protagonists, and adventures or not, and so it's just huge. The comic book is, you know, 30% of the print industry, so it's sizable.
I'm just wondering, as someone, my son is seven and is in first grade, was in first grade last year, and so he came home from school with a couple of cards, and then he wanted to buy some with his allowance, and I let him, and he bought a book with all the characters, and I was like, there's no story in this, it's just all classification of these characters, and he spends a lot of time reading it, and he wants to do more with it, but we don't have ideas, and we don't really watch those kind of cartoons, and we don't have the Game Boy, we don't have any of that stuff. Is it possible for him to participate in that without...
Yeah, there are books, novels or short serialized books that would give narrative to it.
And then he has to have friends who have the cards to play. Mm-hmm. Is there somewhere where he can find the rules to how to do that? Or
the Pokemon webpage, I didn't look on it. The rules. It has a lot of information on it about how to play the game. And at our local comic book store, there will be Saturdays devoted to Pokemon, where you can come in and like learn more about the trading cards, or people can trade it and stuff. But I think at the grade school age, most people learn from their friends. Like maybe someone will have an older brother who plays, and the trading card game is really hard to play when you're seven. I think they do much more with just revealing information and talking about it, but the game is a little bit more complicated, I think.
And the rules are online, and we've gone on to look at them, but it's like, it's a foreign language as far as I know.
If you have gamers in your family, it's not. It's very much like Magic or role-playing games, or in its structure of playing, but yeah, it's very complicated.
Yeah, we don't really.
So the kids just have like cards and they talk about them,
and talk about being a trainer,
If you're at a yard sale, you could probably find some old Game Boy Advance for like $20, $30, and you could probably find a really old Pokemon game for not that much money. That'd be a cheaper way, and you could still, the games, I mean, you could beat them in like 20 hours, but they can take up to like 150, 300 hours to get through playing. It just really depends on your attention span.
The point is we're trying to avoid
There are books. But they're not like, you're not going to read them and say, this is literary quality. But there are books that tell a narrative about the kids catching their Pokemon and the bad guys trying to steal them. And it gives some more narrative to do with the cards.
It's hard as a parent because he's so interested in it and he really wants to do it, and I'm like, I can't help you with this, and none of our friends play it, and so I'm trying to find some middle ground where we can both be happy, and if it's something he's going to sit there and read until 10 o'clock at night, then I'm happy to support him in that, as long as it's within our values. And
right.
So
about the rules, there are there are starter packs that you can buy, beginner packs, at card shops that give a certain amount of cards, and they give rules. There are others that give little playing mats that you can use.
Okay. So a gaming store actually has more than, like, I think there was one I bought mine at Target for here. And there was one that had a starter pack, but we live in a small town, but the comic book store is the one that has more of that stuff there. And they can get you started if you're interested.
Great.
Just a couple observations about your comments, too. When I used to spend a week a month in Washington, D.C., I'm from Oregon. My son was young, but into Pokemon. By the time I finished there, the local toy stores or the KB's or something like that, it's a national chain, had these starter packs for 99 cents for the goal thing, and had a sheet that showed that you could play the game on it, had the rules, had the set of cards all set, so that's actually kind of nice. In terms of cards at school, I don't know if it's changed since I came to you, Lisa. When it was at its zenith, at least, and Chris, maybe you know this too, that one of the reasons our local schools were banning it was because older kids who were more clever in the ways of the marketplace were taking advantage of younger kids and obtaining what were, for whatever reasons, precious cards for great deals for the older kids. And so you would want to maybe still be aware of that.
Right.
We had to be aware, so we had to
had to vet the deal through us before we went through it.
The car deal. But like I said, I mean, I know most of this from, I mean, I did, my research was on comic books in Japan. I spent 2 years, and as I said, my advisor and another student were doing work on toys at the time. So I know most of this from that side, and I just now, and in fact, I realized literally while I was here when I was giving this talk, and we found a Pokemon book down in the...
Pokemon. In the
pool hall, yeah. And so my son started reading it, and I was like, it hadn't occurred to me that he doesn't know about this yet, and is he going to want to come to this talk, and you know, what am I starting by doing the Pokemon talk? So I haven't encountered it directly as a parent yet, but yeah, good.
My comment is way out of another, from another field.
Art?
As a pastor, I'm called to preach according to the Bible and the creeds and our confessions. And we say that that's the source and norm for life. And what I just set that next to what all of what I've heard tonight, or this afternoon, to say what I see in our culture is biblical illiteracy. And the literacy of Pokemon is advanced, and it just seems like something has to change, either with the way we think about Scripture. Again, our forefathers and mothers said it was the source and norm for life, but it has not been that way in our life. And I just, I'm uneasy right now with the way things are. And I'm just trying to set Pokemon in a bigger world than Pokemon.
Yeah, and it doesn't come out of a Christian context, although it's not particularly, I mean, there are links between, Satoshi makes links to, there are no direct references to Japanese mythology or even animism, but there are some, like, even when I was reading about Squirtle to Emmett the other day, there's a line on the card that says, his tail is used as a symbol of longevity. Like, it's a Pokemon, but that kind of mythological rhetoric is used in the cards. So there is a drawing off, again, it's completely fantasy, but there's a drawing off spiritual traditions to some extent. But it strikes me that I'm not sure what we can do with your dilemma unless we can get Nintendo or 4Kids Entertainment or someone to take on a biblical project, right? I mean, this is like massive scale marketing, and how can we do that with the Bible stories? There are tons of great stories in the Bible that you could do that with, right? Just doesn't get done
so
on
I
this
just
scale.
Say that Luther was very aware of the printing press and the graphic artists that conveyed his particular political awareness of the church in his day. It wasn't like he didn't not pay attention to technology. And I think that somehow there's a challenge to not to be sort of like stick your head in the sand and say it can't. Doesn't exist.
Interestingly, there's three new manga Bibles out that came out in the last 2 years. One is, well, it's interesting because it's called a manga Bible, but it's drawn by a British comic artist, but in the manga style. And it does Genesis 1 through 22 and then little chunks of the gospel. It's short. And it's a comic book. And then there's another one that's the New Living Translation, I think. And it's actually the whole Bible, but interspersed every once in a while. There's little chunks of comic books in it done by different Japanese artists. And Genesis 1 through 22 is in there as well, and then chunks of the Bible. And then there's Robert Crumb is making a comic version of Genesis, which is supposed to be out in October, which is extremely graphic and in Crumb's style. And there was just...
Marked. Do you know that one? It's just the Gospel of Mark.
Yeah.
Which is in my classes.
tall also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there are a lot of people playing with, okay, how can we get these stories out in these forms that young people, and we've had illustrated Bibles for kids for a long time, right? And this is sort of some newer versions of that.
I would just almost play the devil's advocate and from a strange position. I'm a biblical scholar, and I'm my husband and I debate this all the time. I don't think that most of these biblical stories are for children. I won't read them to my kids, to be honest. And I don't really, you know, there are some, but I think that often, I think our biblical stories have become so domesticated, you know, two by two, hop on the ark and forget about genocide, that a lot of the meaning is lost, even if they are getting some. And so I think that when we look at biblical story and biblical narrative, I think we have to look at it in a lot more complex sort of way. Also, for my daughter, there are no women in the Bible. I had a conversation with her when she was 2.5 years old, and I used she language. I said, Maharet, you know, she said something about God, and I said, yeah, she does this. And she goes, what do you mean, Mommy, she? I said, God, she. She said, Mommy, God is a man. And I said, no, God can be, and I, you know, and I said, tried to put my professor hat. She ran to her shelf, pulled out her little kid's Bible book, opened it up, and said, look. And so, you know, in terms of some of those sorts of things, I don't know that more biblical, you know, in terms of how we do this biblical literacy and putting a Bible in comics is not an end all. It's violent. It's just, you know.
Yeah, and well, and that's part
and
of why.
And the gender roles are terrible.
Yep. And Crumb's version is both of those things. Directly, right? It fits his style very well for that.
Right,
reason.
Exactly.
And you have to make representational choices the second you start drawing an image to it.
Tons
so.
Of interpretations. So, and what I'm saying is, I'm not against biblical literacy. I'm saying it's fraught with obstacles,
right.
and things that I haven't fully worked out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we just recently had, when Emmett was in Sunday school, and he came home and he had a picture of a chalice and a loaf of bread, and I said, what is that? And he said, the blood and body of Jesus. And it sounded so gruesome coming out of a 4-year-old mouth. And I was like, that's true, but that sounds disturbing. So, you know, yeah, there are complicated things. Also, the image of Christ on the cross is, we sanitize that severely, but that's a violent image,
yeah.
Right? I mean, supposed to be right. So, anyway, from Pokemon to Christ on the cross. Thank you for coming. I think we're past.